You know, some people believe that Jesus is a myth, which is really an impossible conclusion based on the available historical evidence. Some believe that he existed, but he was well-intentioned, a misguided fellow, which again is an impossible conclusion based on the facts of his life. Some think he was a nice guy, good religious teacher, taught folks how to get along, but his disciples took his teaching a little too far. Many, of course, believe he's a savior of the world. But among all the various views regarding Jesus, he's not often thought of as outright brilliant, the smartest man who ever lived. And I don't mean religious smart. I mean smarter than the top educator, biologist, physicist, business mind, computer engineer, artist, musician, salesperson, counselor, all the different forms of intelligence you can think of. Jesus has the best information on everything and, of course, on the things that matter most in human life. Here's how Paul in the first century church thought of Jesus in Colossians: Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. When we read that, we tend to sort of religiousize it. We think, okay, all the religious stuff. All means all. All means all. He has the best information on everything regarding your life and my life. And in addition to being brilliant, he's also very, very good and very powerful. We're in Mark chapter 7. We're exactly halfway through the year this week, week 26. And hopefully we will conclude right after Christmas with our time in Mark. This week we're in Mark 7, starting in verse 24. Let me read it to you. Jesus left that place and went on to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an evil spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek born in Syrian Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. First, let the children eat all they want, he told her, for it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. Yes, Lord, she replied, but even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Then he told her, for such a reply you may go. The demon has left your daughter. She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. So the Lord was likely exhausted by his work. If you've been around this year, you know that the only time he gets any rest is when he's on that little short trip across Galilee. So he's going back and forth. And now he's left Jewish territory and went into a non-Jewish region, and he wanted to keep his presence secret, probably because he wanted some rest. But this mixed-race non-Jewish woman heard he was there and came to him. Now, how she found out he was there? Knowing human nature, here's my guess. He went to some house and said, don't tell anybody he's here. And they went outside and said, Jesus is staying at my house. Can you believe it? That's probably what happened. And so this desperate woman came to him. And because she lived in close proximity to Judea, she would have known Jewish customs, even though she wasn't Jewish. She would have known that it was inappropriate for her to approach a rabbi, a holy man like Jesus. So here are the cultural strikes against her. She, and religious, Phoenician, pagan, a female, a daughter with an unclean spirit. And at that time, those would have been strikes against her going and approaching this holy man. So she's considered unclean, unable to approach Jesus, but she doesn't care. Desperation can do that for a person. She falls on the floor at the feet of Jesus and begins to beg him to exorcise the demon from her daughter. And the verb here is not, please, Jesus, it's please, 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 please. In fact, in Matthew's account, the disciples get annoyed by her or embarrassed by her because she keeps on crying out, making a scene. So they ask Jesus, send her away. Of course, he's not going to do that. If you're a parent, you understand that her boldness is born of her desperation. She might have been normally a quiet person, but being a parent trumps personality. She was unashamed and indifferent what the people thought of her. She didn't care the disciples are saying, you know, what's up with this woman? It doesn't matter to her. Think about her situation. Her little girl is demonized, controlled by this vile, wicked spirit. It's hard to imagine a more horrible situation for a parent to be in. And why was a little girl subjected to this? Well, it's hard to say. I will say this, to reject the existence of demons because of a presupposition is not a rational basis, not a rational position to hold. Some people would say the existence of demons, believing them, is irrational, but that's just not true. When there's good, solid, and ample evidence, which there is, for the existence of something, it's irrational to disbelieve in it. So here a little girl is demon-possessed, but why is this little girl demon-possessed? What has she done to deserve this? Probably nothing. You see, the problem with sin and evil is that they don't just hurt those who deserve it. If I sin especially in some egregious fashion, how many people will suffer for that? My wife, my children, my grandchildren, my friends. You say, but that's not fair. I hate to tell you this, but fair is not really a key factor in reality. It's a key factor in our culture. But what's real and true is what matters in the end. And sometimes our ideas of fairness can hamper our ability to navigate the real world we live in. And here's the real world we live in. God has designed us where there's a world of relational connections. We're designed to have impact on one another. And this is a wonderful thing. The greatest joys of our lives are these relational connections. Our ability to impact each other in deep and meaningful ways in relationship is tremendous. But there's no way to have a world in which only positive relational impact is possible. There's no check valve on relationships where a check valve is where liquid can flow or air can flow one way, but it tries to come back the other way, it closes off. It'd be great if there were relational check valves. Only the positive could flow out, and negative tried to come back, it would close off. In the world we live in, the possibility for positive impact means there's a possibility for negative impact. And so the choices made by some adults in this little girl's life brought suffering in her life. Her background, from even what little bit we know about it, could have easily led to this, her religious background. So it doesn't mean her family were overt demon worshipers, but they likely didn't know the pagan gods that they worshipped and the activities of their worship were causing this harm and allowed this demon to come into this little girl's body. So the sobering thing here for all of us, in particular for parents, is that what we do or don't do has direct impact on our children and our children's children. You say, well, Terry, that's scary. Well, it ought to be honest with you, because the stakes are very high. You say, well, Terry, it makes me feel guilty because, you know, I made some choices, my kids are grown, and I think some of my choices impact my children. Well, the good news is you can take your guilt to Jesus and he will forgive it. In return to your ongoing sorrow over that, my experience is Jesus will take care of your guilt instantly, but the sorrow you got to take to him over and over and over and over. So keep taking your sorrow to him. The best application of this is recognize that because we have relational impact on one another, we are highly, highly incentivized to live a life of holiness. What we do impacts our kids, and this should motivate us in profound ways. I have a friend who, his kids are grown now, but when his kids were little, he told me a story of he was out for a run. As he ran, he saw a pornographic magazine open on the sidewalk. As he turned around, he contemplated running back by for a second look, but instead he decided to reroute and go a different way, which he did. And when I asked him what was his motivation, it wasn't deep love for God in that moment. He's out running. It wasn't some higher values. It was simply he thought about his kids. He thought about his kids. He thought, you know what, I want to be able to pray for my kids. I want to be able to impact my kids. I want to lead my kids. That's what made him reroute. We've talked about it before, but in combat, soldiers in battle situations are not kept in the fight. They don't make courageous choices based on the higher, more esoteric values. That may cause them to enlist or re-enlist, but what keeps them in the fight is love for the person next to them, concern for the person next to them. So you can say, Terry, I'm not a parent. This motivation is not there for me. God puts people in churches. If you're a part of this church, there's a bunch of incentives upstairs, there's some incentives down that hall, and there's some incentives just stood in front of you. And whether these are your biological kids or not, these are all my kids. And if you're in this body, these are your kids. So you're incentivized. Let's move on. The woman's on the floor begging for her daughter, and what does Jesus say to her? First, let the children eat all they want, for it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. Does that ever bother you when you've read that? Jesus is talking to this woman and says something like that to her. And we live in a dog-loving society. This was not a dog-loving society. Dogs were scavengers. They were dirty, diseased, and dangerous for the most part. I mean, some of the upper class had some dogs. But today it's sort of a friendly insult. You know, it's kind of like, hey, Brian, I just ate the last piece of cake. And he goes, you dog. You know, it's not really a terrible insult. But to say it then was a terrible insult. Really more could have been a racial slur. But that's not what Jesus is saying here, and there's some reasons why we know it's true. He's teaching her, it's a short parable. He's teaching her a lesson, and she gets it. Because he uses an unusual word for dog. Usually there's the grown-up word for dog, which means dangerous, dirty in that situation. But he uses a Greek form of dog that's a puppy, a house dog, a domesticated dog. And the woman got it. She understood the difference, and you can tell that she got his point. So he's saying, you know how families eat, the children at the table first, then they feed their pets. But of course, the puppies don't eat off the table before the children do. And Matthew gives a little bit more, a fuller explanation. He said, I was sent to the lost sheep of Israel. And as we know from our time in Mark, the Lord concentrated his ministry initially on Israel. He was the one that the signs and the Old Testament ceremony pointed to. He was the fulfillment of the ages. He did, however, constantly demonstrate compassion and concern for non-Jews. He would not just disregard them, but he was focusing initially on the Jews. It was going to go, like the Lord had called, God had called the Jews out among all the nations to be a light to the nations, and the Lord was going to go to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles. So history was unfolding in front of them. Now, after the resurrection, the Lord was going to commission his disciples to take the good news to every ethnicity, and they did. So he's using this opportunity to teach, which he always does. He wasn't just going around doing stuff. He was very intentional about everything he did, and he was always connecting the why to the what. And by the way, another key parental lesson here in the Lord's activity is to assume your children will not be able to always connect the dots between your purposes and your actions. So two things I would say. First, make sure your actions have purposes, that they're not random what's. And make sure you've thought through and asked the question of why. Do what you do on purpose. And then second, don't be heavy-handed, don't be preachy, but take opportunities to tell them why you did what you did or didn't do what you do in a particular what. Now, I will say learning obedience, even without knowing the why, is a super important lesson for all of us. But in addition to learning to obey, even when you don't understand all the why, it's really important for children to own the why and not just obey the what. And the Lord was a master at this. He used parables to drive home the lessons of what he was doing. And her reply to the Lord was priceless. Yes, Lord, but even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. She doesn't become disrespectful or offended. She simply says, in essence, I get it. I'm not a part of Israel. I was not born into a chosen race. So feed the kids first, no problem. But I believe there's plenty of food to go around. And I'll take the crumbs from your great table. Now, she's not doing what's near universally done today. Take offense, stand on my inherent rights, complain about the lack of fairness. She didn't go find her lawyer to sue Jesus for a racial slur. Instead, in a very bold but respectful way, she exercises faith. Give me what I don't deserve based on my great need and your great grace. And Jesus responds with, good answer. She's the first person in the book of Mark to actually understand one of his parables, it seems like. Last week, he told his boys, after they followed him for all this time, are you guys still so dull? You don't get it. And that wasn't even a complicated parable. This one's fairly nuanced, and she gets it. She didn't fight back for her own righteousness. How dare you call me a dog? I won't stand for it. You self-righteous rabbis, this is why we don't like you Jews, all that. You think you're better than us. She says, and I'll paraphrase, I get it. There's an order to things. I don't know why God chose Israel. I don't know why his purposes for me are what they are. But I accept the fact that I have no right to demand anything from you, just like a puppy has no rights. But even like a puppy in a good home gets fed, I'll take the care given a puppy in a good home. So she's exercising humility and also confidence at the same time. And she reminds me a little bit of the prodigal son, but just from a very different angle. They kind of end up in the same place, but come from different directions. The prodigal son, unlike this woman, was a family member. He had every right and privilege. He sat at the table. And he chose to throw that away and walk away, walked away from his inheritance. Finally, in desperation, because of his own folly, he realizes, you know what? The servants in my father's house are taking better care than how I'm living. I'm going to go back and say, I'm not worthy to be your son, but could I be a servant in your great house? He's seen what the world had to offer, and a servant in his father's house was better than anything anywhere else. And so his father's response, of course, was to throw a party and to welcome him home as a full son. And this woman comes with the same non-demanding response. That's what's going on here. She revealed that she understood the gospel. She had no right to demand anything from Jesus, but she was asking. I'll take grace, whatever form you want to give it to me. And his response to her was, I'm going to give you a place at the table. Let's go on, verse 31. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon down to the Sea of Galilee and into the region of Decapolis. And again, this is not just Mark just sort of randomly just thinking of stuff to write down. He's writing down, just like the Lord lived with a purpose, Mark is writing with a purpose, and all this is pointing to the bigger picture of what the Lord was about. Some people brought to him a man who was deaf and there's one word in the Greek, could hardly talk, was mute, and they begged him to place his hand on the man. He took him aside, away from the crowd, put his fingers into his ears, then he spit and touched the man's tongue, and he looked up to heaven, and with a deep sigh said, be opened. At this, the man's ears were opened, the tongue was loosened, and he began to speak plainly. So, next, Jesus encounters this deaf and mute man, and watch how Jesus deals with this man with tender mercy. He takes him aside, and he didn't always do that. Sometimes he dealt with people right there, sometimes he did, but he was situationally aware. He knew what was best for people. And here, this man was likely insecure, probably very self-conscious about his limitations. Jesus didn't want him to feel like a spectacle. And Jesus just never used physical actions, no hocus pocus, nothing that would make it look like he's using some kind of magic. He usually just spoke and it happened. So why does he do some unusual actions here? Well, because he's being kind to the man. The man can't hear. So he touched his ears and he touched his mouth in order to bless the man. So he's using essentially sign language. And then Mark uses a very rare word to describe this man. It's a single word that's translated hardly able to speak. The only other time we see this word in the Bible is a Hebrew version of it, which is in Isaiah 6. And let me read the larger context, because this is a messianic Old Testament prophecy pointing forward to Jesus. The desert and the parched land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It'll burst into bloom. It will greatly rejoice and shout for joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the splendor of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. Strengthen the feeble hands, steady the knees that give way. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear, your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution, he will come to save you. And then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer and the mute tongue shout for joy. And water will gush forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. So here you see this happening. This is a picture of what Jesus was doing. Deserts are blooming. It's a visualization of the impact of the gospel on hearts and families and cultures. Feeble hands and weak knees, symbols of impotence, are going to be strong and courageous through the gospel. Mute tongues will shout for joy, just like this man Jesus heals in the narrative. But Isaiah said that God will come in that time, and he'll come with vengeance, with divine retribution, he will save you. Now, the common thought was the Messiah would come, and his divine retribution would be him and his sword whacking the Roman government. But that's not what happened. So where do you see divine retribution saving people in the gospel? Well, Jesus saved us by taking on divine retribution. Isaiah went on to state this clearly in Isaiah 53:5. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we're healed. Paul said it like this: God made him who had no sin to become sin for us, that we might be the righteousness of God. So Jesus in his first advent did not come to bring divine retribution, but to bear it for us. Okay, so in the course of our message this morning, I've pointed out some side or some secondary lessons we can learn from the life and ministry of Jesus. And I did that for two reasons. One, because they're valid points. They're valid side lessons, connecting the why to the what, and doing things on purpose. And those side points are valid, but also wanted to make this point was those side points are not the point. Jesus was not a universal problem solver. He didn't solve the problem of poverty. He said the poor will be with you always. He didn't solve social injustice. In fact, social injustice was perpetrated on him. He didn't take care of all the physical disease and death that existed at his time. And all those who he did heal died again. He didn't end war. He didn't end divorce. He didn't cure all the lack of education. His life and ministry were not a series of how-to lessons. How to get along with others, Jesus' way. How to be a parent, Jesus' way. How to be a great athlete, Jesus' way. He was not merely a challenging role model. He had a very specific ministry and precise calling. He had a vocation to complete. His miracles and his movements were not random. They pointed to his purpose. So his remarks to this non-Jewish woman were veiled but very accurate. He didn't just come to randomly help a bunch of people in temporary fashion. He didn't start a series of medical clinics or counseling centers or schools. He came to complete a very specific mission. He was the long-awaited Messiah, but not the one they had envisioned. He didn't restore Israel's national fortunes. He didn't immediately end the suffering of the righteous and vanquish the wicked. His movements and his miracles validated his message. He was the Savior of the world. His death on the cross was a death for us. And his primary mission was to accomplish what many people then and still consider to be barbaric, out of place in the modern world. But you know, the cross of Christ has always been out of place in the modern world, because now is always the modern world, and it becomes the postmodern world or the formerly modern world. Here's what Paul wrote about the then modern world. The message of the Christ is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those who are being saved, it's the power of God. It's always seemed silly and barbaric and stupid to people who don't understand it. The Bible, God, Jesus, life itself becomes confusing when we fail to understand why he came. He was the most brilliant person who has ever lived, but he did not come to solve all of our problems as they stand or as we see them. If I trust Jesus, he will fix my marriage, my health, my habits, my past, my future, my debt, my unpleasant job, my kids, my coworkers. He'll fix all of that. And then when those problems persist, people become disillusioned. What good is he if he doesn't touch me where I really need him? Sure, there are secondary applications from the life of Jesus. He was the smartest person who ever lived, so it makes a lot of sense to look at how he lived, look at his actions, and look at his attitudes, and try to emulate them, because if he's the smartest guy ever lived, God in the flesh, I want to try to align my life and attitude and actions with his. However, the prime application of his life is that he came to solve our greatest problem, to meet our deepest need. He bore our sins, which wasn't fair, so we could bear his righteousness, also not fair. Thank God the world is not about being fair. Doesn't mean he left all the other issues of our lives untouched. As many of you know, a life aligned with Christ will inevitably begin to impact marriages for the good, and children, and workplaces, and social settings, and our physical habits, and the like. I've known many people who became Christians, and it transformed their physical bodies because God gave them power to live a different way, to stop using certain substances, and it transformed. There's people in this room who, when they came to Christ, God transformed their marriages. In addition, what Christ did not do himself, he compels and empowers his people to do. Many followers of Christ have started hospitals and schools and given their lives to stop social injustice and take care of orphans. In fact, much of what's been done in human history along those lines has been done by those empowered and motivated by Christ. But all this is made possible because Jesus did what he came to do, purchase us for God. It would have been compassion if he had decided, I'm going to spend every moment I have on earth healing physical disease. It just wouldn't have been wise, and he was really smart. He could have said, you know what, I'm going to try, this is really helping people. People like being healed. I mean, I know they're going to die again, but they like us, so I'm going to try to get along with the government, be nicer to the Jews, maybe I'll skip the cross. With my healthy lifestyle, I do a lot of walking with my influence, not to mention I'm a deity. I should be able to maximize this body, get another 50, 60 years. I could do a lot of good in that time. He could have started lots of social programs, healed tens of thousands of people. He could have started a Palestinian network of Jesus of Nazareth medical and counseling clinics. But instead, what did he do? He allowed himself to be killed at around 33 years of age. And in so doing, he accomplished his purpose to meet our greatest need. And so you skip to the end of the book. You were slain, and with your blood you purchased men for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. So his mission and his impact transcended the first half of the first century. It goes to the end of the earth, to the ends of time, and beyond. And really, our calling is similar as followers of him. We have pressing needs and issues to attend to. But our overall life purpose has to be more about just paying attention to the next pressing need and issue. In his name, we should seek to have good marriages, relationships. We should seek to make a difference in the community where he's placed us. We should, as he leads us, turn around social injustice. All that he calls us individually and corporately to do, but our purpose, like his, really is transcendent. It's lived out in space and time, but it is eternal in its purpose and ultimate application. So we have to be able to find joy in being found faithful, even when his plan works out very differently for each of us. This woman got this. She didn't say it's a big ripoff that I wasn't born a Jew, and it's a ripoff that God chose those people to carry his name. All that didn't matter to her. She got it. And you know, and some people are going to trust God and their marriages are not going to work out because the other person chooses differently. Some people are going to follow God and the gospel, and they're going to have transformed physical bodies, but they're still going to die. You're going to work with an orphan, and 10 more are going to get produced in the world by human sin. You're going to be a Christian doctor who helps people who are sick, and they still die. You build a good marriage, and a spouse dies. Yet we never experience vanity in any of this. That's the power of the gospel. There's no part of our lives that are vain. Vanity means in the end, what we do doesn't really matter, so it really doesn't matter what we do. But what we know from the gospel is that we have been rescued from vanity forever. Let me leave you with a verse. Therefore, my dear brothers and sisters, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. That's because the gospel has rescued us forever from vanity. Let's pray together. We're going to spend some more time in worshiping the Lord. And let me encourage you, if you haven't given any thought or much thought to this, would you think a little bit about the fact that Jesus, he is holy, he is pure, he is God, he is all those kind of things that we think of him, but would you train your mind, begin to train your mind to think of him as being brilliant? And what are the implications for brilliant and good and powerful? What are the implications for your life? Think about that as we worship him together.